God damn it! My life has value!
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Sit up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of You Have Tread on Me Radio. Today is April 19, 2012, and today is a rather important day in the history of United States of America. And we're doing a broadcast in commemoration of this day. Lots of things have happened on April 19th throughout the history of the world, but, you know, it seems really, really interesting things happen on April 19th in the U.S. here. So we're going to be doing a broadcast tonight, like I said, in commemoration of that. One of those really important things was that shot heard around the world, if you will. Lexington Concord, the American Revolution, where our militia mustered in a matter of an hour. Well, out of Lexington, I believe that at Lexington there was over 400 troops that mustered in under an hour and went to meet the British at a bridge. So tonight's going to be an open mic type of night. We got a few people that are going to be on with us. We got Fox on, Gary Hunt, myself, Sleepy Salsa. Although myself, I'm not going to be on the whole night. I've got things to do, and so I'll be on for probably about the first half hour, and then I'll leave it up to everybody else tonight. I know there's an announcement that Gary's going to make tonight as well. So, with that being said, welcome everyone. Also, if anybody wants to come on, like I said, this is an open mic night, so let us know. You're more than welcome to come on. Let's hear your thoughts on what you guys are talking about. Why is this day important to you? So with that being said, let's get this thing on the road.
All right. Well, thanks, Randy. Hey, everybody. This is Fox. It's nice to be back on You Have Tread on Me Radio. And, you know, I started the April 19th tradition last year. I think we should keep that going. And I think we need to start with a moment of silence for the men who lost their lives on this day in 1775.
Well, you know, you're right. Actually, you did start this last year, didn't you, Fox? I forgot about that. And, you know, thanks for reminding me about it today. Hell, I forgot about it today even. It's just been a hectic and crazy last 2 weeks for me. So I appreciate you reminding me about that. Sleepy, what about you? What is this day? What does April 19th bring to mind for you? Why is this day important for you?
Well, it's important because it's a historical example of when brave men and women stood up to tyrants and just demonstrated to the world that human beings can have the balls and the fortitude to actually do the right thing, which unfortunately is all too lacking in this time period in any case.
I know that's right. Yeah, is that you, Gary?
Yeah.
You going to come on? How about you? What is it? What about you? What brings to mind? Well, what comes to mind when you think about April 19th?
I'm inclined to agree with some things I read from some old historical text. I mean, we all know that July 4th is celebrated annually, but back then it seems that April 19th was what they called Patriots Day, was more significant in the minds of many people than July 4th. July 4th was always celebrated, but April 19th was always celebrated because April 19th was not the Declaration of Independence. It was the beginning of the Revolutionary War that gave us independence. And so many people back then felt that it was the most important holiday, and I'm inclined to believe agree with them, because it wasn't a piece of paper, as Sleepy said, when people were willing to stand defiant against the existing government authority, not in abeyance with the laws, but in violation of the laws against those people, the British, they proved that they had the fortitude to take on the greatest military force the world ever had. And if that is less significant than a piece of paper, it is beyond me why it is. And I think it should be celebrated every year, but I can understand why the government doesn't like that symbolism.
Well, you know, anything that reminds people that we're free, or reminds people that others have stood up in the face of tyranny, tyrants never seem to like that. You know, they just don't like that symbolism. They don't like that spirit of independence and freedom coming up in people. And unfortunately, you know, other countries that have been in a state of slavery forever. Let's take China, for instance. The entire history of that country, over 3,000 years, those people have never known a day of freedom. And you know, one man stepped up in front of a bunch of tanks at Tiananmen Square. That's their little symbol of freedom there. You know, but unfortunately, he stood alone. Nobody else stood with him. Luckily, in our country, a few people stood up, and then a whole bunch of other ones stood up with them. So, you know, I really do want to tip my hats to those gentlemen from way back in the day who actually were willing to stand up and say, we're not going to be slaves to you anymore. We are free men.
Well, if I may cut in, I think a few things need to be said about, you know, the 3% that you hear about nowadays, that only 3% openly fought against the crown. And at the surrender at Yorktown, there were actually more Americans or more colonists in the field against General Washington than there were for. And also that there was bloodshed long before April 19th. I can't remember the dates, but it was about a year beforehand, the powder alarms, three or four alarms were sent through, much like the alarms that were sent through Lexington and Concord, and there was bloodshed. And in one instance, the King's infantry had successfully seized powder and arms from a county militia. And once the county militia heard about that, they surrounded that little fort of about four British grenadiers, and they were massacred because they refused to surrender. There were battles before April 19th, but April 19th was the spark that set off the powder keg and really got everybody to understand that, hey, this is going to happen, you know, whether you like it or not.
Well, what about you, Gary? We think back to that day and those early colonists. You know, are we descended of those men?
Well, some of us are, I'm sure of that. I know that my family, I've got seven ancestors that fought in the Revolution, and I got some Tories that were relatives. Fortunately, the direct line is not. But you were talking about freedom in China. And, you know, about a year ago, I started studying English history. I'm not finished with the 9 volumes yet, but started studying English history because I thought it was fascinating that this evolved through in the whole concept. Came from England, of all places. Well, it didn't. It actually came from northern Germany on the coast, the Jutes, the Saxons, and the Anglos, who migrated to England and the Great Britain, the islands, and they took with them a concept of freemen. And they also had two classes of citizens, and they also had slaves. But the concept of freemen has endured throughout British history, and it existed very few other places in the world through many, many centuries, and those places would only be the city-states, small republics. Only on a large scale did it occur in England. So it's something that became a part of that Anglo-Saxon heritage that came from Germany through England to the shores here. And I'm not so sure that well, get into a touchy area here. I'm not sure that people of other races really fully understand that. Are they, you know, dogs or shepherds or they're routers or they're hunters? They have different characteristics. They're different breeds. Is it true of people, too? Is it only a certain combination of people that really can understand the concept of freedom? And to look at that a little more in perspective, how much of this country is not of that heritage, and how quickly is freedom leaving our shores? I'm not sure that in China they've ever really had freedom or ever will. I'm not sure that in Africa they will ever really have freedom as we perceive it. I mean, the Africans tend to be tribal in nature. They want a chief. They want somebody to lead them. The influence of the Muslims in Spain pretty much left that stigma in Spain and even up into France. The Far East, the China, Japan, Korea, have always wanted a leader. I mean, you hear their talk about freedom, but none of them have really ever come up with the type of concept of freedom that we have in this country. And so it seems to be unique, and I know the founders felt that it would spread throughout the world. They were absolutely sure that it would, but for whatever reason it didn't, and the only thing I can think of is what I've just mentioned, that some people just, in their genes, they don't have a full idea of taking full responsibility for your own life.
And it's interesting that you...
So I do believe it's unique to America.
I know, just when you mentioned that, when we look back at, you know, where these concepts came from, we were talking about the old Saxons and everything like that. You and I had this discussion before. You know, who brought this concept of freedom to England and so forth, and that was the Saxons. You know, those barbarians, those Vikings, the Norsemen. Well, I guess they were descendants of the Norsemen anyways. And, you know, they did enjoy their freedom to an extent. You know, they did pay homage to a king of sorts, but really, every man was free. They could come and go as they chose to back in, you know, in the Saxon countries and stuff. So, I don't know, what do you guys think about that? Anybody else want to key up there?
Well, the Constitution itself and everything that was done, the founders were very good at learning from history. And if you look at the Constitution, if you're a lawyer, you can find the loopholes. But I think it's beautifully written. And the only thing that this country really needs to do to keep the Constitution is to understand the spirit and to uphold it. And everything is exactly right. It's unique. It's unique to the world. You know, nobody's ever seen freedom on this level, even especially now. It's kind of complicated what I'm thinking and trying to say it, but...
Well, you know, something you said was interesting was that, you know, lawyers can go through and look for the loopholes. You know, that was something that our founding fathers had talked about, was the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law. And, you know, that's an important concept there, because it's not about what the law says, it's about what the law was supposed to mean, what it was supposed to do, what it was supposed to secure or protect. You know, and when you get into the letter of the law, you know, that starts going into ways that, you know, that starts getting into manipulation of that spirit to bring about a specific agenda for those who seek more control.
Right, you know, to understand it, to uphold it, we need to understand it. And to understand it, we need to understand the spirit of the founders. And in that, we can look to the Federalist Papers, we can look to George Washington's writings. You know, you can find novels upon novels of things that he wrote, just personal essays. The Federalist Papers themselves are, that's a big book in itself. And
the Anti-Federalists, I think the Anti-Federalists is even more important, because that spoke specifically about big government and you know, the tyranny that would ensue with big government and the fears of some of those founding fathers about big government.
Yeah, they all learned from history. You know, they were the example to be set of a people learning from history and understanding that, well, you put the wrong person in there and things are sure to go awry. And I saw a political cartoon that was written or drawn, and the picture was of the signing of the Declaration in Independence Hall, and the little subtitle at the bottom says, "Well, shouldn't we put in there something about if we elect an idiot or something to that extent?" And I'm thinking to myself, "Yeah, we do. It's already there. It's the second article to the Bill of Rights."
That's a good point.
You know, the entire Bill of Rights, as a matter of fact, the 10 chains that keep the government down. You know, we're supposed to be on top. We're supposed to be standing tall. They're supposed to be listening to us. And this is a concept that sadly is forgotten now.
Well, sure, when you look at most of the people today, you know, even those amongst patriots, everybody wants more, you know, all these people who call themselves Republicans or right-wingers, you know, they all want more laws. Everybody wants more laws. They want the government to write more laws.
There ought to be a law. That's what you're talking
there
about.
There ought to be a law.
Everybody wants laws in their favor. And they don't want to take the responsibility for other people to have rights. And that was not true in the Constitution. I'm trying to find a book, and I can't find it right now, but it was called Ratification, and it talked about the state's ratifications. And when you talk about intent, we always hear about what happened in Philadelphia in 1787, and nobody ever talks about what happened in the first nine colonies in 1787 and 88 and 89 during the course of ratification. And something that was one of the objections, which was rather interesting, was the one that allowed direct taxes. And there was strong objection to it in at least three of the conventions. The Federalists assured the Anti-Federalists that direct taxation would only be used in the event of an emergency, such as the Revolutionary War, where they had this enormous debt to pay off because they got caught up in war. But it would only be used in those emergencies. And since 1942, it's been a mainstay of providing the government phenomenal economic resource to do anything they want in the world. So instead of it being a result of the war, it has become the cause of war, the direct taxation. Had they stuck to the intent of the Constitution, as presented by the Federalist, and was the cause for ratification, that was one of the arguments in the South especially, that was that the Federalist had to say that there because they wouldn't have gotten ratification. And so that becomes the intent. Then what we have today, where our wallets are open to the government to grab as much as they want, it has become the cause of war. The direct tax has become the cause of war rather than war being the cause of the direct tax. And, you know, studying those aspects of history that we need to get into to understand what truly was intended. Now, on Oath Keepers, we had some discussions a while back, and I ended up leaving it because they didn't like me saying the things I did, so I just courteously left. I wasn't asked to leave, but a lot of the jibes were pointed at me. But what it amounted to is rule number two of Oath Keepers, that nobody will make an unlawful arrest. Well, a lawful arrest, according to the Bill of Rights, requires that a warrant, presentment or indictment by a grand jury. So when a cop arrests you because you spit in his face or cuss him out or don't show him your driver's license or anything else, he's making an unlawful arrest. Unlawful search is the same thing. There's no right to make a search unless the judge has issued a warrant for the search based on probable cause. And of all the people I know that have had their property searched in the last 20 years, and that's probably 8 or 9 people, not one of them was ever shown the warrant. This includes Waco. Not one of them was ever shown the warrant that was attempted to be served. Now, the problem is we have 3 constitutions out there. Surprisingly, there are 3 of them. One is the one that the sheriff or the chief of police tells his employees is the Constitution, and you have a right to make these searches, you have a right to make these arrests, you have a right to intimidate people, all kinds of rights that aren't in the Constitution. Those are the ones retained by us, not by the state, but by us. The second Constitution is the one that came as a result of the Supreme Court back about 1916, and then Brandeis in 1936 told us what the Supreme Court had adopted toward as rules for application of tests of constitutionality in the Supreme Court. And the last resort was to rule on the constitutionality. He gave, I think it was 9 points. The last resort was to rule on the constitutionality. If they ruled on the constitutionality, they wanted the interpretation to be as narrow as possible. And all the other elements that Brandeis told us about said had to do with administrative agencies standing and things like this, which is why you really can't get into court right now. So we've got the legal interpretation of the Constitution as given to us by the Supreme Court, which does not go along at all with the intent of the Constitution, and then we've got the Constitution as written and intended by the Founding Fathers, which in plain language, there is no means to find loopholes. There is only the means to obfuscate the meaning. Shall not be infringed is pretty strong wording, and many of the statements of the Founders about the right to defend against government are pretty profound in what they understood the need for the Second Amendment to be. So the problem we have is obfuscation. We've lost the Constitution to the attorneys, and even more so to law enforcement, not peace officers, but law enforcement officers, because they all look at the Constitution slightly differently. A true patriot would look at the Constitution and do whatever he could to find out what the original intent was and abide by that. But it's only a true patriot that will uphold and defend the Constitution as it was written.
And I agree with you. You know, when you look around today, and I'm dealing regulatory agencies, where Congress delegated the authority to make laws or rules, if you will, because they're really not laws; they're just rules that this agency makes up that are then enforced at the end of a barrel. And unfortunately, you know, they have a lot of ends of those barrels that they like to point at people. And, you know, that's the overall threat. You know, if you don't obey, we're going to fine you. And if you don't pay, we're going to come and get you. Or if you don't obey, we're going to come and arrest you. And if you don't obey, then we'll be forced to shoot you. But everything is always backed up with the threat of force. And our founding fathers were quite clear on the threats of government, the threats of an overly large centralized government, the threats of a freestanding professional military, the threats of agents of the government. You know, and that's the problem we have today. You know, somehow we've gotten turned around, and we now have law enforcement agencies. We now have all of these organizations that impose their will upon we the people. And yet, if any will was supposed to be imposed, it was the will of we the people imposed upon the government. As long as it's not violating anything that went against that, you know, the Bill of Rights or the set powers of Congress. And even then, the will of the people was final, because even in the Declaration of Independence, it says that we have the right to change or abolish government when it no longer suits our needs. And so we sit today confused. You know, we think that those guys who come and kick down doors are the good guys. We think that you know, all these attorneys and judges and everything are the good guys because they protect us from the criminals. And yet, a lot of their actions in themselves are criminal. Again, where are the arrests? You know, where's the indictments from the grand juries? Oh, I forgot. We don't need those anymore. We got rid of the grand juries. We have warrants signed by judges now. What happened to the state?
And thanks to the Patriot Act, we now have warrants signed by federal officers on site.
We got doorstep warrants. You don't want to let me in? Great. Here, let me whip out my little notebook. I'll draft out a warrant real quick. There you go. There's your warrant. Well, gentlemen, listen. I hope you guys have a really good show tonight, a really good broadcast. Let's talk about all the things that happened on April 19th, because it wasn't just the Lexington Concord. Lots of things happened on April 19th. I've got to get out of here, though. I've got things to do tonight, and I've got an early morning. I've got an early start in the morning, so I want to wish everybody happy April 19th, happy Patriots Day. Remember this day. Let it sink in. Think back to those men who actually said no and stood up, and then were willing to put their principles on the line, and not just their principles, their asses on the line, and go and meet the world's most powerful army, and say you will not intimidate us anymore. We will not comply. We are free men. So that being said, everybody,
tread on me.
Be free. Take it away, Sleepy.
All right. Well, take care, Randy. We'll definitely see you later and all that good stuff. But yes, obviously today is a very important day. Just like July 4th, there's a lot of significance and a lot of really imperative lessons to really take away from it. And, you know, I find it interesting that, let me start off with this. Would it be accurate to say that the Redcoats were government agents?
And, well, they had their own tax collectors. They had their own customs enforcement, if you will. Are you referring to the regulars, the soldiers?
Yeah, the guys that that were shot at by the militia. Yes.
Oh, I would say yeah, because by their force, they were imposing the king's will upon a people who decided the king's will was no longer legitimate.
Well, if you compare them to today, they're like the police department is today. They are militarily armed. They come in force. Now they have body armor. Back then, they had felt jackets. They were the epitome of the standing army the founders were concerned about. And if you look at how the founding fathers perceived the standing army that was mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, you would understand that the police force, which is about 1 million strong, or law enforcement, which is about 1 million strong in this country right now, is the standing army that the founders feared. They were working in the capacity of a standing army where they used force. Force wasn't used for arrest very often, search. Most often people were cooperative, but when the government comes in with guns, hey, you can expect the other guy to come back with guns. But yes, they were resisting the police force. They stood against the police force and said, you're not going to do this. And they weren't allowed to do that. They didn't do very successfully that day anyway.
Right, exactly. And so I find this interesting that, we've all heard about the shot heard around the world. And there was a video that I posted in the chat room a little bit ago, but if you guys listening later on the podcast version, go to YouTube and type in "You Are Not the Boss of Me." And it was a very intriguing speech by Larkin Rose. I think it was only several years ago. And in that speech, I guess you could say the main thesis was that a big point of today, as well as the revolution in general, is that, you actually have to pick up your rifle and actually go fight tyrants. And not just, I mean, that's kind of like the really obvious part, but there's all these other aspects to it too, where you're not acquiescing to whatever the enemy wants. You actually have to, you know, brave men and women have to actually risk their lives and go fight these criminals. And so I would say Larkin Rose was right about one thing. I mean, he was asking the crowd, I mean, how many of you people now would be willing to do the same thing? And the crowd was basically quiet. And I think that kind of speaks volumes in a very unfortunate way.
But you used the phrase, shot heard around the world. And, you know, that didn't come out until the centennial, the 100th anniversary of the Lexington and Concord. And I think it was Emerson that wrote a poem that called the shot heard around the world. Nobody ever looked at it that way. If you go back to the period of the time, the British really gave a better demonstration of what occurred at Lexington and Concord, began at Lexington and Concord, than the shot heard around the world reflects. They played a tune called The World Turned Upside Down. And it was probably very appropriate, because here this ragtag army of farmers turned the world upside down by defeating the British. Now, the surrender of Yorktown, they played that tune. So if we get it in perspective, I don't like the shot heard around the world. I prefer, quite frankly, the world turned upside down. And maybe once again, we need to turn the world upside down.
Exactly. And, you know, I prefer not using Wikipedia as much as possible, but I think maybe reading a short bit from Wikipedia and then double checking it, I think, would be good, as far as those of you guys who don't know what Lexington and Concord were all about, especially the, you know, 13 or so anons who are in the chat room right now. And I think that's probably a record almost. Hey, guys. the battles of Lexington and Concord were the first military engagements of the American Revolutionary War. They were fought on April 19, 1775 in Middlesex County, province of Massachusetts Bay, within the towns of Lexington, Concord, Lincoln, Menotomy, present-day Arlington, and Cambridge near Boston. The battles marked the outbreak of open armed conflict between the Kingdom of Great Britain and its 13 colonies in the mainland of British North America. About 700 British Army regulars under Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith were given secret orders to capture and destroy military supplies that were reportedly stored by the Massachusetts militia at Concord. Through effective intelligence gathering, Patriot colonels had received word weeks before the expedition that their supplies might be at risk and had moved most of them to other locations. They also received details about British plans on the night before the battle and were able to rapidly notify the area militias of the enemy movement. The first shots were fired just as the sun was rising at Lexington. The militia were outnumbered and fell back, and the regulars proceeded on to Concord, where they searched for the supplies. At the North Bridge in Concord, approximately 500 militiamen fought and defeated three companies of the King's troops. The outnumbered regulars fell back from the Minutemen after a pitched battle in open territory. More militiamen arrived soon thereafter and inflicted heavy damage on the regulars as they marched back towards Boston. Upon returning to Lexington, Smith's expedition was rescued by reinforcements under Brigadier General Hugh Percy. The combined force, now of about 1,700 men, marched back to Boston under heavy fire and a tactical withdrawal, and eventually reached the safety of Charleston. The accumulated militias blockaded the narrow land accesses Charlestown and Boston, starting the Siege of Boston. So is that in introduction to the Wikipedia article on the battles of Lexington and Concord fairly accurate or not?
It appears to be, except the numbers that accumulated at Concord, I think, is in dispute. The books I've read, and there's a lot of more recent research going on, and I think the internet is a source that people can read books that they otherwise didn't have access to, like Peter Force's American Archives and minutes or the notes taken at the various state conventions. The The Minutemen by John Galvin, which Randy and I have talked about before. The Minutemen, the first fight, myths and realities of the American Revolution, is rather interesting, but it implies that there were at least 1,000 people on the two hills looking over the road from Concord back to just outside of Concord, from Concord back to Lexington, and no firing broke out. The Patriots are standing on the hilltops looking down. The British are going down the road on the lowland, and no shots broke out. But some of the militiamen had gone down to a bridge where the creek crossed it, and something happened down there, and firing started. And at that point, just the hordes of Patriots started taking better positions and started shooting at the British and what became known as Battle Road. But the estimate then was nearly 1,000. And the other estimates, now it's hard to count when you've got little militia here, militia there, and then you've got just groups of two or three people leapfrogging along shooting at the British. But the estimates I read get up to about 3,000 by the time the British got to Metonymie, which was near the beginning of the end of the battle, because they were getting in the area more populated by around Boston. So I would only dispute the numbers. Basically, the rest of what you said is probably true. Now, another thing that's come out more recently is two diaries of officers that were at Lexington. British officers, and I know everybody's going to say, but I'm inclined to believe it, everybody's going to say that, oh, they just said that. But no, they didn't come out and advertise it. The Americans got the first press back to England, so the American story became the prima facie story, and whatever the British said was presumed to be an attempt to cover their ass. So the Americans said the British fired first, but these two diaries indicate that the first fire, they saw smoke at a stone wall off to the beyond Buckman's Tavern, which would have been to the right of the British and the left of the Parker's men. And so very probably, and I wouldn't doubt that Sam Adams talked somebody into doing it, because he was made a comment to John Hancock when they were on their way to, can't think of the town right now, but they were leaving. And Sam Adams said, what a beautiful day. And Hancock thought he meant the weather. And he said, no, it's just a beautiful day. So when you put the pieces together, I think the greatest likelihood is that Adams set somebody up to fire the first shot and get this thing going.
Well, when the militia mustered and met the British, I think it should be said that they were in a very defensive posture at that point. The famous quote by Captain Parker, you know, stand your ground, don't fire unless fired upon, but if they mean to have a war, then let it begin here. As offensive as that seems, it's extremely defensive. And I think that was, well, personally, this is just from my own research and my own thoughts and meditations on the matter. I think it's indicative of how everybody was feeling that day. Very defensive and very weary of starting a war with the greatest military power on the earth at the time.
Well, I don't disagree with what you said about Parker and the militia. What was suggested by the two British diaries, officers' diaries, was that somebody that was not of the militia was behind a stone wall, which would be across the road, probably almost directly across the road from Parker's men, who were on the green right off the road. And so this guy fires a shot. It could have been a Tory. It could have been a Patriot. But those are the only written accounts. The many affidavits that were signed that day, nobody could say for sure in the affidavits who fired the first shot. But the affidavits were only taken from the Patriots, not from the British. The British didn't attempt to do that, but there were dozens of affidavits recorded within the next few days by the people that were on Lexington Green and at Concord regarding what happened at Concord. So it doesn't dispute what you're saying, and I don't think that they wanted a fight, it would have been rather awesome. These guys have cannons, they have long rifles with bayonets, and these guys, some of them had bird rifles, and they had to overcharge them to even draw blood. So, you know, it was very, from an armament standpoint, it was very imbalanced. And I don't believe any of the people in the militia really wanted to get into a fight that day. But once the fight started, then the attitudes changed. Some were known to have fired at least a couple rounds at the British as they were fleeing. Some were shot dead. But for the most part, everybody fled and got off the battlefield and left it to the British. But the guy behind the stone wall was probably never found. But they did report that smoke, it came from that direction, and they saw smoke. Remember, they didn't have smokeless powder then. They saw smoke by the stone wall. So it's hard to, you know, there's no way to tell for sure. But the story that we've got is the one by people like Emerson, the shot heard around the world, and the midnight ride of Paul Revere. Why Paul Revere? He's the only one that didn't make it. He's the only one that got arrested and taken back to Lexington and then got released. So why did he become famous? And we recognize him now as the famous one when, in fact, he was the least successful of all the writers. So that's the colored history, and that's something we need to take into consideration, that for 230 years we've had history colored to make it more appealing to... Well, another book I read was rather interesting because it was... 30 or 40 years before people started writing down the history of the Revolutionary War, because it was all fresh in their minds. They were satisfied, but as children came up and started asking questions, they wanted to start writing the history down, preparing history books for the students to learn about the history of the country. But you're writing this for children, and you know the rate of education generally was a hell of a lot slower then than it is now. So it had to be simple, and so we got into this names, dates, and events. For example, Boston Tea Party, then Lexington and Concord. But so much happened in between. But it was just confusing because it wasn't a single event that you could hinge history on. So they left out all that happened in western Massachusetts for the year prior to Lexington and Concord, and went from the Boston Tea Party to Lexington. And They simplified history. We want heroes, we want events, and we want dates. And so everything evolved on that. And then they wanted color to it, the shot heard around the world, 100 years and before that came up, 100 years after the Declaration of Independence before that came up. So, like I say, with the resources we have now, we can better look at what probably happened. It's easier to look back now than to look in the textbooks and get an idea. I've got, you know, 5 books that were written in the last 10 years about April 19th, 1775. And they all tend to dispute, well, the one myths and realities of the American Revolution. I've got another book, Myths of the American Revolution. And they go through a lot of these things and point out that they came much later. Some of these descriptions of events. George Washington never chopped down an apple tree. And I forget who the author was that decided that that was colorful and it would appeal to the school children and teach them honesty. And he never tried to throw a dollar across the river. And, you know, all these, this mythology is something that was written for children.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, something else about the 19th that I think that's not really mentioned all that much is, of course, Samuel Whitmore, who was the oldest known colonial combatant of the entire Revolutionary War. And again, I posted a link to the Wikipedia article in the chat room. And again, if this doesn't sound right, guys, just let me know. But according to the article, it says that... on April 19, 1775, British forces were returning to Boston from the battles of Lexington and Concord, the opening engagements of the war. On their march, they were continually shot at by colonial militiamen. Now, Whitmore was in his fields when he spotted an approaching British relief brigade under Earl Percy, sent to assist the retreat. And obviously he was a farmer, so that's why he was out in his fields. Whitmore loaded his musket and ambushed the British from behind a nearby stone wall, killing one soldier. He then drew his dueling pistols and killed a grenadier and mortally wounded a second. He managed to fire three shots before a British detachment reached his position. Whitmore then attacked with a sword. He was shot in the face, bayoneted 13 times, and left for dead in a pool of blood. He was found alive, trying to load his musket to fight again. He was taken to Dr. Cotton Tufts of Medford, who perceived no hope for his survival. However, Whitmore lived another 18 years until dying of natural causes at the age of 98. So there's a monument in Arlington, Massachusetts, which reads, "Near this spot, Samuel Whitmore, then 80 years old, 80 years old, guys, 80 years old, killed three British soldiers on April 19th of 1775. He was shot, bayoneted, beaten, and left for dead, but recovered and lived to be 98 years of age." I got to admit, that sounds really impressive.
And if you ever go to Massachusetts, when I was there, 17 years ago, went to the Battle Road Park or Monument or whatever it is, and they've got a building there that was restored, a building that was originally on Battle Road at the time. And you can walk about a mile of Battle Road. There are stone foundations of houses. You can see where wells were and things like that, there, except for the one house that's the part of the Park Service's property. It's pretty much as it was. Now, the trees are bigger, obviously. They're not getting cut down for farming or anything, so the fields are overgrown. But when you walk that road, it is rather interesting because the road, as I said earlier about at Concord, tends to be low and follow pretty much parallel the creek. It deviates away. There's, you know, one of the old ruins. You can see the creek behind it and the roads out in front of it. I wouldn't have wanted to have been British then. And if you read the accounts of some of the British soldiers, there was the most. Some of them had participated in significant battles, and they felt that that was the worst they've ever felt in combat because they had to march, they had to stay in order, they were trained British troops, and they were getting picked off. And the high ground, sometimes only 10 or 15 feet higher, sometimes stone walls nearly level, sometimes after you got past Lexington, there was a hill on the right side that was about 80 feet above the road, and apparently it was lined with Patriots, and there were rocks and trees on the hill, and it was lined by Patriots, and they were shooting the British as they made this curve around this hill. You know, going out and seeing it, you really get a perspective that you don't get out of a book. And to me, it was kind of fascinating to go to that park. If you're ever in Massachusetts, I would suggest you make the trip. It's only about 20 miles from Boston.
A very good book, if I may put this in here. It's called Paul Revere's Ride, and by David Hackett Fisher. And he wrote a few books, and I've read most of Paul Revere's Ride and George Washington's Crossing. It goes into extreme detail, and it's all backed up by National Archives and personal memoirs and diaries, and it's all very accurate, and it has all these things that we're talking about and more. Paul Revere's Ride actually begins in 1772, when things were really starting to get hot with the Samuel Adams and the Sons of Liberty. And I just wanted to throw that out there. That's a very good book for reference.
Well, there are a lot of good books out. Believe me now, if you go to books like that where people studied them rather than grabbed it out of a textbook, you'll find a lot more. But yeah, Paul Revere was a writer for the Committees of Correspondence long before Lexington and Concord. And he was one of their more recognized writers at the time, but he had his own business, so he didn't have to go to the boss and say, "I want some time off." He had the apprentices take over the shop when he had to make a ride. And apparently he made some rather long rides during the course of that time, sometimes hundreds of miles, which on horseback is a little more arduous than getting in your car and driving that. But I would recommend to everybody that there are a lot of books available. The one I mentioned, the Minutemen by John Galvin, is one of the best, because what's intriguing about this is, I think we all know now about committees of safety, thanks to Randy's marketing. But this book, the Minutemen, talks in pretty extensive detail. Even though it focuses on the militia, it shows the relationship of the militia to the committees of safety, and in one case, the militia from a different county could not leave the county without permission of the county committee of safety, and it took 7 hours to send a rider to the county seat, find an officer committee of safety, and then carry the word back that they could chase the British. And they would have been lined up on Battle Road, but as it was, they didn't get to the scene until the British were almost back to Charleston. But if you really want to understand the relationship between militia and committees of safety, that is one book. And then there's another one called American Insurgents, American Patriots by T.H. Breen, B-R-E-E-N. And both of these are published in 2010, in the last couple of years. The one by Breen, American Insurgents, American and Patriots, goes into great detail on the effect of the committees of safety and this whole effort for war, how it brought people together even before the war began, had the organization in place, the parallel government that eventually took over. It's just filled with well-documented information about the role of committees of safety. Sleepy's the librarian tonight. He's got the links for both the books up there. They're really worth your time to read those books if you really want an insight into what really happened rather than the heroes, the events, and the dates.
Right, and also in honor of today as well as the revolution in general, I did post, or I should have posted the link, to the Revolutionary War Drill Manual by Baron von Steuben, which, listening later on the podcast version, you can simply go to the blog, type in Revolutionary War Drill Manual, and you should be able to get it for free download. But, yeah, I mean, that's something important, too, is you can kind of get an idea for what needed to be done to kind of get the Continental Army kind of whipped into shape. They were having a lot of trouble before Valley Forge.
Well, the sterilized version leaves the events distant from real people. Only the heroes' names are mentioned. And as you study the Revolutionary War history, Paul Revere or Nathaniel Greene was a fascinating one. He was probably the best general Washington had. When you read these and see where the common man came into play, you can start picturing yourself as one of those common men. And so your perspective changes because you're not looking like at Disney, looking down on a diorama of what's happening. You're in the diorama as you read these books, and you understand how they felt. You hear their words. You hear what they say about the events that are occurring. And if you do that, I think that you will see you have been grossly lied to by the government school system. Now, it's not just the government school, because even before the federal government took over the school system, we still had a rather sterile version, but it's been more sterilized, as Randy has pointed out, on committees of safety. He couldn't find it in, I think, two encyclopedias and a number of other books. The only thing he found was the committees of public safety, and those are the guys that ran the guillotines in Paris. So it got hidden from us. But now we're seeing two books that deal very specifically with committees of safety, and I've seen a number of others that refer to more to committees of safety than anything more than about 15 years old. That you go back 15 years, and committees of safety are very difficult to find. And then somewhere around 15 years ago, in the late 90s, people started writing more and more about the committees of safety. So we're beginning to get that truth of history now. And so when we look at April 19th, 1775, and start thinking what it would be like to be on behind Parker, facing the British, and then a shot is fired, you don't know where it came from because you're facing away from it. And this is what the affidavits pretty much said. Nobody saw it, but they were facing away from it. But if you put yourself on that battle line and realize that all of a sudden these well-trained British troops first start firing, and then they start charging with bayonets, some of the men stood their ground and fired as many times as they could before they were bayoneted or shot. Others fled the field. But those that fled the field, most of them participated on Battle Road later on that day. It was the shock of the moment that caused them to flee. The unexpected had happened. And once they got their head back on straight, they became participants in the beginning of the Revolutionary War, that first day. The day the world began to get turned upside down.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, speaking about committees of safety, obviously, since that's always a fun topic around here, you know, I just finished reading a book fairly recently where it was about Benjamin Franklin's life, and it was only mentioned on one page, but apparently he was actually a chairman of the Pennsylvania Committee of Safety during... Benjamin Franklin, actually.
Oh, yes, you read me that.
Right, he was the chairman of the Pennsylvania Committee of Safety during the war, and, you know, he organized the militia, provided, you know, did all the logistical stuff, too. And so, you know, I got to admit, though, I can't remember the last time in the public school system when, or even in a lot of private schools and even some homeschooling curricula, to be perfectly honest, where that was mentioned, or about committees of safety just in general and how integral they were. I mean, we always hear about committees of correspondence. We hear about that ad nauseum. And arguably, they were the colonial version of what we think of now as the alternative media, unless you would like to dispute that.
I'll dispute it.
Okay, cool. but yeah, we never hear about the other one. We always hear about the Continental Army. We hear about the Continental Congress, and all these other facets. But I just kind of find that a key instrument, a key tool that was so pivotal to making the whole thing happen, just being completely ignored. And, you know, speaking about today, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but I thought it was I don't remember their name right offhand, but I believe the committee of safety for that area were the ones that actually gave the orders to the militia to go stop the redcoats today. I thought that's what happened, if I remember correctly. I just don't remember their name right offhand.
Run that by me again.
Well, I was reading something, and I could have sworn that it was actually the committee of safety around the Lexington and Concord area that actually gave the orders to that militia, to those militia units, that to actually stop the redcoats.
Yeah, the committee of safety told Parker to call his troops, and they called them in the evening, and then they had them stand by, go home and stand by. But when they heard the drums, they were supposed to assemble. Some guy came riding up the road and said, "The British are coming." So Parker had the drums played, and they came out. But yes, the muster was at the by the authority of the committee of safety. The original muster, and then it was in Parker's hands. They knew the British were coming. It was not a secret, as the British had intended.
Right, but you never really hear about the fact that militia was not just some like random bunch of guys out in the woods having a good time, and they said, "Oh, there's a bunch of redcoats, let's go stop them because they're trying to take our guns or something." No. They had their civil authority, and they followed the orders of that COS, and that COS obviously knew what was going on.
Well,
but
Disney
all that's omitted.
Disney made a movie called Johnny Tremaine back in the 50s, I think. And at the same time, which was common back then, It was common to, it was back in the, let's see, where's the copyright date on here? Well, this printing is 1996 copyright.
Well, if you're talking about the movie, I think that was 57.
And this book first came out about then. Now the one I've got is copyright 1970. Copyright was renewed in. The book was written in 1943 originally. And I saw Disneyland on television back when I was a kid. Every night of the week they had Disneyland and the Mouseketeers and all that stuff. A whole different world than we live in now. No violence, nothing like that, except in the movies, Davy Crockett and things like that. But I remembered the movie, and I read the book more recently from 1943, and both of them dwelt on the Committee of Safety, and Johnny Tremaine had gone to a Committee of Safety meeting and everything, and so I decided to track down the movie. I found it online, and I played it. And there's only one reference. He's talking to some British guy, and he mentions the Committee of Safety, but he doesn't go to the meeting. So apparently the reference to the Committee of Safety was removed from the movie, even though it's still in the book and was in the original movie. So it appears that there was an effort. Disney was an interesting fellow. He had a dishonorable discharge, and he proudly displayed it behind him on his wall. He would never charge what they charge to get into Disneyland now. He wanted it to be available to everybody. And he liked the truth of history. And so when Johnny Tremaine was made, he was alive. When Eisner re-released it, and I'm not sure when it came out with the Committee of Safety removed from it, it was cleansed. It was took away that aspect. And it's significant that the government doesn't like the concept of Committee of Safety because it's a parallel government. It's the people. The First Amendment, the right to peaceably assemble, is there. The right to freedom of speech, which is also the right to freedom of thought. Those things are inherently there in the Constitution. Hate crimes can't be hate crimes under the First Amendment because that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, and so I have a right to hate somebody, but that's being taken away from us by machinations, by attorneys, and by the First and Second Constitutions I mentioned. But the loss of the Committees of Safety was a phenomenal one. And I'm sure the government was probably pissed off at Disney back then when Disney put it in the movie in the first place. So, yes, the Committees of Safety are absolutely necessary to achieve the type of revolution we had 230 years ago. It cannot be achieved without it. There's been no revolution in the history of the world that had a peaceful transition of government as we did. When I say peaceful transition of government, I mean just that. The government never went through great difficulty. It has had problems. But it wasn't a battle to see who was in power. The power was established to a significant degree before the war even began, with the First Continental Congress in 1774. That government carried its way all the way through to 1789 when the Constitution was, 1781 with the Articles of Confederation, and 17, there we go, throwing dates and events, not shit. 1789 and the ratification of the Constitution. So this smooth transition is unheard of in history. If we take the American history out of the world, it does not exist.
Huh. Wow. So, yeah, interesting. It's been fascinating to watch the literature over the years to see just how much of it. It's not even so much the fact that it's getting dumbed down, although that's a part of it, but also just like it was described in the fictional novel 1984, you'll see a lot of details just getting just deleted from the histories. You'll literally just have, you know, like the new history or some sort of, you know, the 20 millionth version of revisionism of some kind, and just stuff will just be left out. It doesn't matter how true it is. You know, it'll just be left out. And then obviously when people try to make stuff happen now, there's no context for doing that. And so, like, for example, you know, Gary, I kind of remember back in, I think it was 2009 or so, where there was that supposed Continental Congress, which, of course, if you go to their website, you can buy the DVD set for $20 or whatever it is. They got to fund themselves somehow, I guess. But, of course, the problem there was that it was just a bunch of folks who just decided to get together or some such thing. It wasn't a genuine grassroots style like what happened with the actual – with the original Continental Congress. It was completely different, but yet they took the name and acted as if it was the same. It was very bizarre. So it was almost like they were trying to reconstruct it, but they just did it badly. They just seemed to just do it from the top down. And then, of course, is it really any wonder that, you know, there's that famous YouTube clip up where Michael Badnara gets in front of all of them and says, "This body is completely psychotic." I was like, well, I mean, what do you expect? Yeah, you guys kind of screwed up a little bit. But, yeah, who knows? I mean, maybe we can get something else going. Yeah, a little bit in the future, but obviously COS would need to be set up first and have that be reliably done. But you know, you can't go into the future without knowing where you've been. I'm just saying, Fox, what do you think about that, man?
I think that goes right back to what I had said earlier. The founders were astute in understanding what happened in history beforehand, and the way that they crafted the government and building the committees of safety and creating the Continental Congress, having all these things in place, not just as a form of defiance saying, hey, we're going to do this ourselves, but it made our revolution unique. As Gary said, the peaceful transition. Without the committees and without the Continental Congress, none of that could have been possible. So everything about this country is unique and special. And, you know, I don't really have much to add to what you guys are talking about. I'm not as well versed with the history as you guys are, but I understand the spirit, and I understand what, you know, I understand what I need to.
Right, and in the chat room, you know, Evenhand had some very good comments. He said, in that movie, Johnny Tremaine goes to Henry Knox's bookstore and asks for a job. Now remember, Johnny Tremaine had just burned his hand badly with molten silver, and Knox turned him away because Tremaine was a cripple, and Knox had his left hand turned from the camera. Knox was missing two fingers on that hand. So, I have watched Johnny Tremaine many times. Tremaine was the lesser of two boys who were watching the store down below while the Committee of Safety met upstairs, and you know, one of them being Sam Adams. And this occurred twice in the movie. Watch it again to see.
Yeah, I'm going to have to watch it again. I saw his comments, but I do believe in reading the book you find different references, and I do believe when I saw the movie the first time there was a lot more about the Committee of Safety, and there might have been a couple references when they were downstairs, but I seem to recall that he had gone to the meeting and met all the players, Sam Adams and all the James Otis, and all these people were sitting around the table. And so he had actually gone into the meeting, and that, you know, some of the things probably could not be taken out of the movie, but I do believe that some of the other ones, the stronger ones, more significant, were removed from the movie. I'll have to go back and review it, and I don't know if I can we can even find an old version of the movie because they weren't readily available, but maybe we can find running time from the original movie and running time of the current as well. I'm going to have to spend some time on that. I don't think more than 5 minutes would have to remove those elements, because I do remember him walking up, though, and I think he took some mugs up there and set them down, and he was introduced around the table, and there was a little conversation that went on while he was there, and I don't recall that in the recent version of the movie, and I'm trying to find out if I've got the recent version of the movie up for download if anybody wants to watch it or not.
Yeah. Right. And it's kind of, so I think what we're kind of pointing out here is that even in the 40s and 50s, when that book came out in 43 and the movie in 57 or so, there was basically acknowledgement, at least in a tacit or passing sense, that you needed some, even if they didn't call it, but something that was like a committee of safety. It's not just, you know, guys running around with rifles randomly doing stuff and, you know, everyone calling each other colonel or whatever the case is. It was a serious effort. There was a civil authority. Guys had to follow orders. The proper militias did close order drill and lots of other things that were kind of imperative when you're going to actually have an actual military unit. And so I find it very, intriguing that as time has gone on, there's been a display of less and less and less of that. For example, in that HBO miniseries, John Adams, you know, terrific miniseries about John Adams himself, but how was everything else portrayed? I mean, Sam Adams is kind of this, he looks like a psycho. They probably did that on purpose. They made the sons look just like a bunch of rabble rousers. But there really wasn't a lot of there was basically no focus at all about committees of safety or militia for that matter. It's like, wait a minute, this is about this is like the 1770s. This is kind of important. I mean, come on. I mean, even John Adams would have come across a COS and a militia at some point. But the only things you actually see are, you know, his cousin with the sons, and then you see eventually the Continental Congress and a little bit of the Continental Army, and that's about it. So it's kind of a gradual, I don't want to say censorship, but it's just being ignored to death, I think, is the problem. And it's funny, you know, I go around to various other aspects of alternative media, even so-called patriot alternative media, and I say, hey, how about them committees of safety? Ain't they cool? And the guys go, what? What are you talking about? I mean, committees of correspondence? Oh, wait. No. See, so even there's still a lot of confusion even now. And
committees of correspondence go back to the Stamp Act Congress in the 1763 or 64 when they first formed, so that the colonies shared information. So they predate the Committee of Safety's involvement in the revolutionary aspect by 10 years. But, you know, it's easy to talk about them because that's just communication. Oh, I said I was going to dispute your thing on the committees of correspondence, too. The committees of safety now need to look at internet communication, email communication, telephonic communication, CB radio communication, and couriers. The only nearly absolutely secure method of communication is couriers. And in the event of failure or control of the other systems, we would have to resort back to the elements of the original committees of correspondence, which was couriers. And so my dispute hinges on that. The internet has not replaced it. It has facilitated communication. But in that facilitation, information overload? It has made it difficult to sort the wheat from the chaff. So I would not compare the two by a long shot unless you set up an internet communication that is dedicated and not subject to interference from any source that wants to put information out that, I hate to put it this way, hasn't been approved or verified to be true. So I don't see the equation.
Right. Okay. That definitely makes sense, because I guess you could say that the internet's more of a it's more like a carnival in a lot of ways. Well, I mean, there was one guy who at this time would prefer to remain somewhat anonymous, but he called it the carnival of distractions, and I think he's absolutely correct. So even
I think that's an understatement. Actually, that's why I was laughing.
Well,
I hadn't heard it before, but it's an understatement. It is a carnival. It's a chaotic carnival.
Right. And so even when there are people who are trying to do serious work within the carnival, it either gets lost, or even if it's effective, the degree to which it is effective is greatly watered down than it would have been had the carnival not have been a carnival, but instead something more serious in and of itself. So you have that kind of on top of that. It's and it's funny, you know, some of the proprietarian anarchists as well as others have referred to the internet as the only true agora we have right now. And I think that's kind of stretching it a bit, because the agora is only about the market, like an open marketplace with no regulations, no government interference, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think that's fair. I mean, yeah, there's an agora aspect to it. That's true. But I think it would be more accurate to say it's more like a carnival. I mean, you know, distractions and that, as you would say, that chaotic part. I think that's a little bit more accurate. And so, yeah, considering how you've explained it, I think it would be more honest to say that the internet is not, and I would say most of the alternative media would not be Committee of Correspondence, because of not just because of the interface itself, but also how, just I guess you could say organically, how people treat it. You know, it's not like a system of couriers that follow orders or anything like that.
No, but to be prepared to have that infrastructure in place, which the Committees of Safety did. They had the Committee of Correspondence. The Committees of Safety need to think about couriers. And it is not that difficult, because even in larger states, San Bernardino is the largest county in the continental United States, in California. And it can take hours to get across. But if we went from county to county, each county was a node for communication. So you go from county A to county B and give it to the courier in county B. He takes them from B to C, and you can go across the country. Now, as long as you've got a car, you can do it pretty expeditiously. If you go down to the level of riding horses, it's going to slow down a little bit. I mean, 20 miles a day is a hard ride on a horse, unless you set up something where you've got horse transfers like the Pony Express did. That needs to be included in the planning for the infrastructure when the committees of safety are formed, very definitely. Now, Sleep, you're familiar with something that you and I have talked about in the past, and that's the Committee of Digital Correspondence, which is an effort. And what we need is a good programmer, somebody that can help put together the page structure that's necessary for it. I have trouble with HTM, and so if there's any volunteers out there, we want to structure a page for Committee of Digital Correspondence that becomes an electronic network that is secure in the communication going through it. It's not going to pass on garbage. It's not going to talk about September 11th or the bombing of the Marat building or anything that's speculative in nature where the facts can't be properly presented. The first article and the only article to date that's gone out under the CDC is... some of you may have read it. It was Shattered Illusions, and it was about the lady that was camping in a campground in Texas. And E-Dog, you're going to love this. She's the one that saw Charles Dyer and talked about her experience in the federal government intruding into their lives and shattering the illusion they had of what the government really stood for in this country. They made the government made patriots of some everyday people that had no idea what the patriot community was in a matter of hours. And so that story was it was definite. It was true. The lady, you know, we edited some things for clarity, but basically it was the words of Carla, who was that lady, the mother and wife, that went through that ordeal. And that's the kind of information that we want to get out through the CDC and other communications. If something happens, what was important back in 1763 is if somebody burned down a tax man's custom house, the word went all over the colonies. It could take days or weeks to get all from one end to the other, but the word got out. And it was if internet communication doesn't allow us to transfer that information, we need to know what's happening elsewhere, not for coordination purposes, but for basic understanding of how severe things are getting in the country.
Right, of course. And I don't think we got a chance to do this a moment ago, but you know, as Fox said, let's just take a moment of silence and just, you know, in honor of the guys who could live no more because of what they did at Lexington and Concord. Okay. All right. Well, so what I think is very important to keep in mind is, I mean, there are obviously a lot of things that demand our attention. There's a lot of stuff going on, you know, in our own lives as well as, you know, in the country and in various states and that sort of thing. But I think it's important to kind of put the brakes on whatever else is going on, like this month, or whatever else is going on this month, or whatever, and just kind of remember how a lot of us got started, and why, and like what are the kind of special days that kind of help remind us about why we do what we do, why we care about securing our liberties, why we're interested in defeating tyranny as much as we are. And also looking historically at those incidences when it was successful, and reminding ourselves about, I guess you could say, the happy stuff. I don't know about the rest of y'all, but I would consider Patriots Day a very good day, just like July 4th.
Well, that would not serve the government, so if you try and do it, they'll probably call you an unlawful assembly and break you up and send you to jail. Unless you stand like those people on Lexington Green.
Yeah. And, you know, just like Fox just typed into the chat room, because there's been some very interesting activity there, call to order. Maybe we ought to spend this time remembering and meditating on the momentous occasion that happened this day in 1775. Exactly. I mean, that's why we're even, you know, usually YHTOM only does its broadcasts on Sundays and Tuesdays, but we had this special one today just because it's a very special day today. And I have to admit, the guys in the chat room can be pretty funny on some occasions with certain things, focusing on, you know, this distraction, that distraction. Again, I mean, what did we just mention a moment ago? The internet can, in a lot of cases, be a carnival of distractions. And if anybody want proof in the pudding, I mean...
Let me read something that predates Lexington Concord by about 4 months and a week. December 12th, 1774, the Maryland delegation, based upon the Committees of Safety at the Royal Government, met in Annapolis, Maryland on December 12th, 1774. They came up with a number of resolutions. Some were non-importation. Probably the most significant one is the last one. Resolved unanimously that it is recommended to the committees of each county to raise by subscription or in such other voluntary manner as they think proper and will most be most agreeable to the respective counties. Resolved unanimously that it is recommended to the several colonies and provinces to enter into such or like resolutions for mutual defense and protection as are entered into by this province. As our opposition to the settled plan of the British administration to enslave America will be strengthened by a union of all ranks of men in this province, we do most earnestly recommend that all former differences about religion or politics and all private animosities and quarrels of every kind from henceforth cease and be forever buried in oblivion, and we entreat, we conjure every man by his duty to God, his country, and his posterity cordially to unite in defense of our common rights or liberties. So they said then, you've got to put all your quarrels, personal, public, political, and religious, aside and bury them in oblivion. And that was the attitude that permeated the colonies at that time. This is just one that I've run across. That you have to put your differences aside, and unity is the way that's achieved. Without that unity, without that common purpose, and without that the constant bickering that creates division, that can never be achieved. We could not achieve what they managed to achieve in the colonies 230 years ago. approximately 230 years ago. I'm not being specific if somebody wants to call me on it. But we need to think that way. And is it something to consider? Now, I hate to go back into this, but back in November of last year, a group of people got together to put together a Patriot Unity Coalition. Now, today is the founding of the Coalition of American Patriots. The link for the Maryland, what I just read, is Sleepy just posted up there. But at committee.org/CAP, this is an effort to achieve that end. Now, it went according to the guidelines until people didn't like the guidelines. So some of the original people that are sincere in wanting unity and not division have come out of the ashes of, maybe we should have called it the Phoenix, out of the ashes of the old Patriot Unity Coalition to establish the Coalition of American Patriots. We don't want to get in a fight over the name, even though the name was offered by me, but I'm sure Minuteman has taken down the pages. That we have to start thinking along the lines of the founders. So this is modeled after what happened back then, that we've got to stop trying to cut each other's throats, claim that we've got the right program, they've got the wrong program. We've got to come together at least in terms of our relationship in dealing with the government. Not how we deal, but the manifestation of the overall effort being a cooperative one. If we can get rid of the division and come together in some common forum, even though we've got diverse means of going about it, if we're working in the same direction, we can defeat the government. If we're scattered, little groups here and there, everywhere, divide and conquer, then we are exactly where the government wants us, not where we want to be. So I would encourage anybody with any organization out there to go ahead and join the Coalition of American Patriots so that we can begin establishing some of the elements that existed, that had to exist for this country to have come into existence.
Wow, that's some really powerful stuff. But yes, guys, if you go over to committee.org/CAP, you'll see the main page for the brand spanking new Coalition of American Patriots. And I would do suggest that you go to the link that's about the Maryland Resolves, because that is the historical backbone behind it. And it's true. I mean, we all need to bury our animosities and quibbling and bickering and all that stuff, because otherwise nothing will move forward. If you've ever noticed, a lot of the proposed solutions that various other people in alternative media have proposed for various things, whether it's like a local alternative currency or setting this thing up or that thing up, necessarily requires working with other people. And so, but then why do those things never happen? Well, or very rarely happen? Well, it's because a lot of those folks would prefer to bicker with each other instead of actually working collaboratively with each other against the enemy, who is an equal opportunity oppressor. So, again, I think it would be really important to start from ground zero and say, look, you know, no more. Stop the bickering. Enough of it. Grow up and be adults. And I think what's important is that I think that CAP serves is that you essentially agree to not do that kind of things. I mean, again, guys, go to the guidelines. They're fantastic. And, you know, if people actually follow the rules that they voluntarily contracted into, then there should be really a minimum of problems. Now, I find it fascinating. You know, your run-of-the-mill constitutionalist will wax eloquent about some level of government not abiding by the Constitution, which, if you think about it, is really a list of rules that they should abide by. And then when they do their unconstitutional stuff, they are breaking those rules. I think that would be fair to say that's one way of thinking about it. Well, similarly here, too. You know, if you contract into CAP and then you don't follow the rules, well, are you really better than the enemy then? So to rise above those that we seek to have victory over, let's start with kind of like during like FTX training or whatever. There's those three phases of crawl, walk, and run. Well, let's crawl at this point and see if we can abide by the rules for something that you know, that we all voluntarily contracted into. And I think this is a, you know, these guidelines are frankly fantastic. They're terrific. And I do think that if given a serious effort, I do think that CAP can very much be successful.
Now, understand the purpose is if a dispute arises and one person brings it to the CAP advisory board, last time it went to the entire membership and it was chaotic. So this time there was a smaller board established of people that are interested and don't want to participate in drama. But when it goes to the entire group, it becomes drama. So this small group then will look it over and see what merit there is and do some sorting out, get some evidence and everything before it ever goes to the rest of the delegate members to deal with. So it's a mediation board trying to quash the infighting. It doesn't have any power to hang anybody by the neck at sunrise or fine anybody $10,000. It's just an effort to try and get the yelling, the barking dog element away from it and get people to sit down and stop bickering. And it's interesting that we want the government to abide by the Constitution. And so we established guidelines, and everybody that joined the PUC agreed to those guidelines. And when the guidelines were used to present a matter to the PUC, they decided they didn't want to agree by the guidelines anymore, which is why we've restructured it to try and keep it out of that brawling room and in a small group of people that have shown a greater interest in their commitment rather than just joining, actually participating in trying to resolve these problems. So that was the biggest change. And so, you know, some people have said, well, it's a shame that PUC died. Well, yeah, it is a shame that PUC died. And, but if we think about it, two things good came out of that. One is the people that forced that division and refused to abide by the guidelines have removed themselves, so we don't have to deal with them. And the other one is that we've learned by that first approach at dealing with this what the shortcomings were that allowed it to become a brawl. And so we've endeavored to address the latter by making a smaller board of people that are willing to involve themselves in the drama. And the other element, we don't have to deal with people that don't want to put aside those animosities, rather want to bring up animosities that never existed before. So I'd recommend you all go there and join that. Anybody who joins today will be, the founding members were people that carried through from the old PUC. The inaugural members will be those that joined the PUC, I mean the CAP today, April 19th, what year is it, 2012. So if you want to be recognized at least as an inaugural member, I would suggest you go there and sign up now. So, Sleepy, come on, wake up.
Ha ha, but yes, reading from the purpose, you know, the purpose of this coalition is to bring together all patriot-oriented organizations or other entities that have patriot-oriented websites under one common banner, to look for the common elements of each group and its purpose, and to focus on that commonality, thus avoiding focusing on our differences. This coalition is not intended to be for exposure, rather for unity. Oh boy, that was a big deal, actually. That means that we will exert whatever effort we must to overcome those elements that wish to create division amongst us. Yeah, and that really is it in a nutshell. And I found it funny that some people were interpreting, you know, PUC as like a thing for exposure and getting your links for your websites out there. I'm like, well, I mean, technically, in a manner of speaking, when you look down the list of member organizations, that's true, but that's a byproduct. That's a secondary or tertiary level thing. That wasn't like the prime reason. So, I mean, no, I'm thinking. Well, think about it. Patriot Unity Coalition. It's not the Patriot Exposure Yep. Coalition. Although that sounds a little dirtier than I intended it to be. But it, you know, it wasn't Patriot Exposure Coalition. It was the Patriot Unity Coalition. But then it was all about exposure, you know. And it's just like, okay, that's interesting. Don't know where that came from, but okay. And then it's, you know, it's not good for you know, certain folks to not abide by the guidelines or do other heavy-handed things. And so I think it's good to really have something else that, you know, where you contract and you abide by the guidelines and then you follow it. And then for the most part, everything should be hunky-dory.
It should be, yes. And if we've got, I really hate to say this, but I think it needs to be said. And that's a tough one. I'm not a politician. I prefer to be as much as I can of a statesman. But when people persist in creating division, you've got to question their motivation. It can be one of two things. It can be ego. I want to be king of the hill. Or it can have more sinister implications. Now, in talking with other people about other things that have occurred lately, everybody wants to shake it off as just a personality conflict. But you've got to wonder if it really is, because this is kind of like follow the money, but it's not pointing a finger because there can be other reasons. But who is most interested in seeing division within the Patriot community? Is it a guy with an ego? Is it the guy that wants to get his constitution back? Or is it somebody that has the best interest of the current government at heart? Well, it could be ego, because all you're seeing is the manifestation of a personality conflict. Or it could be somebody intentionally trying to create as much division as possible and keep people at odds with each other so that they can't work together. And I got to say that second one kept occurring to me these last few weeks, and I think a lot of you know what has occurred, and I think we're going to remake a show that didn't come off very good a couple of weeks ago when we get a chance to, so that the evidence can be laid on the table and the judgment be made by those who wish to see the evidence laid on the table. So anyway, back to April 19th. If we start thinking not the shot heard around the world, but instead the beginning of the world getting turned upside down, I think that we have a more positive image. It's not the shot. It's not the violence. It's the fact that the world is going to get turned upside down again, and the Constitution is going to come back up to the top this time. It's like a ship that these unsinkable ships, but the unsinkable ship is upside down. It's floating with a bow towards the sky, and we've got to turn that ship back over where the Constitution is on the top and right that ship again, get it back on the course that was set 220 years ago with the Constitution. And so let's start thinking, turning the world upside down one more time, just like the Founding Fathers did.
Right, and I did want to take something from the chat room. Evenhand again said that I was at a constitutional class tonight and the subject came up. If you disobey unconstitutional laws, you will go to jail or prison, and people are convicted to get rid of them nowadays. I brought up in the class that there is a level of maturity this movement has not reached, that being the supporting of those convicted and the families of those convicted at large. Otherwise, there is a liability. We will be picked off one by one.
Well, there's probably a lot of truth to that, but support is a rather interesting element. What is support? Is it throwing money at it and feeding the attorneys, the sharks? Is it trying to sway the jury, which should never be done? The jury should be swayed by the evidence and nothing else. Now, we know the court system doesn't present the proper evidence. They're very selective in what is admissible and what is not. This is a far cry from what existed 200 years ago. The best way we can support those patriots that get caught up in the legal trap that the government has set for all of us, if they can impose it upon us, is to restore the Constitution and get back to what the Founding Fathers intended. The grand jury has been subverted. The grand jury 200 years ago, the grand jury foreman was in charge. Now, the U.S. attorney, the state attorney, or the county attorney is in charge. And in most cases, the jury can come back with a grand jury can come back with a presentment, and the county, the state, or the U.S. attorney, if he doesn't sign that presentment, it is a no bill. It means it doesn't count. Grand juries used to be turned against the government as often as they were turned against people. Now they're only turned against the people unless the press forces it against a cop. The petit jury, same thing. Some constitutions, Maryland, for example, very explicitly said that a jury has the right to judge the facts and the law. But we've lost that, and you go into a jury pool, and they start questioning you as a juror, and they say that if you say anything about I have the right to judge the law as well as the facts, you're out of there. If you don't want jury duty, that's the quickest way out. As soon as your attorney opportunity comes up, say, I understand the jury has the right to judge the law and the facts, and hey, they'll ask a few more questions for show, and you'll just sit there. But you might as well just say, now I've said that, can I be excused? And they'll probably let you get out of there, because if you don't, if they don't get you out of there, you might taint some other jurors and get them to realize what should be. So the ability to do what they're doing goes back to what I mentioned earlier about Ashwander and the Supreme Court ruling on constitutionality only as a last resort. It goes back to corruption of the grand jury, corruption of the petit jury. And so these things are going to happen, and they're enforced by people with guns and body armor and tanks and everything else. So until we get back to where justice can prevail in this country, that is the best support we can give these people, hopes that when we achieve our goal, they will be released and become free again. If Charles did get 30 years tonight, I'd like to think he'd be out in 5 years. And if we exert ourselves in the proper direction, he could be out in 5 years. If not, he might be eligible for parole in 15 years. But at that point, on parole, if he steps out of line one time, then he goes back to prison. But if we prevail, then he's a free man, which he should be now, but apparently is not. So the support is not throwing dimes at or dollars at or demonstrating or making accusations against people because they may or may not be good. I'm going to say this. They may or may not be good guys, but it serves no useful purpose to get that catfight going between two sides that allege to be supporting Charles Dyer. I can see bad on both sides. From what somebody told me earlier today, a video came out today, an audio, a conversation that's alleged to prove somebody's a bad guy. It doesn't prove that, but it's the type of stuff that creates division. So both sides on this Charles Dyer matter are creating divisions by attacking the other side. It's a shame they can't work together. And it's a shame that they can't keep their guts if they want to work from opposite sides. Both sides. Got that, E-Dog? Both sides. Somebody needs to rein in both sides. And maybe we can get to a point where we can police ourselves and keep things from going in the wrong direction and creating this division. And once the division is created, people feel that they have to take sides. And once they take sides, it doesn't matter what the truth is at that point, unless some form is found where the truth can be laid on the table and judgments made. And then everybody accepts the truth.
Right. And, you know, there was something that was mentioned in the chat room earlier, and I'd like to read it because I think it's very apt. That, you know, it would be preferable to drop the Charles Dyer issue for now, since this is a special show on a day we need to be remembering. Not a special show to have basically people argue about the Bible, aliens, and a former Marine who made a few videos on YouTube. I mean, guys, there's always a time and a place for everything, and I think the fellow who made that comment really understood that. Now, Evenhand also said that the point of unity should be the same thing as it was in 1776. Is it right for an island to rule a continent? Then it was Britain and Great America. Then it was Britain and North America. Now it's Washington, D.C. and the United States. Now, the Continentals were a badass mix of Northern Yankees, wild frontiersmen, Southerners, poor and rich, German speakers, Dutch speakers, Scottish speakers. You can't get a consensus like that except for the one idea of, no, it's not right for an island to rule a continent.
Well, I don't think that that's apples and oranges. If you want to put it in perspective and you want to use those terms to do it, is it right for people on high and dry land to be ruled by people that built a city on a swamp? Remember, Washington, D.C. was the cheapest land around. It was a swamp before it became a city. It took many years to haul enough dirt in to even build the buildings on. It's not that. Look at the other side of it. What is representation? The colonists weren't represented. But by the same token, are you represented? If, for example, some guy's running for president, he says, read my lips, no new taxes, and you vote for him. Are you voting for him because he said, read my lips, no new taxes? Now, what happens when he gets in office and just a few weeks later, he asks for a tax increase and new taxes? Now, does he cease to represent you when he's gone against what you elected him to do? Let's go further. Taxation without representation. Who's being taxed right now? You are. Your neighbors are. I'm not going to say I am because I'm not. But collectively, we're being taxed. Wait a minute. No, we're not being taxed. Not nearly as bad as our children or our grandchildren. The debt now extends. Payoff of the debt now extends over 30 years into the future. I'm going to be gone by then. My grandchildren are going to be paying a debt that was put in by people that are going to be dead like me, and they're going to have to pay the obligation of that taxes. Now, the epitome of taxation without representation, and Jefferson spoke to it, that he should, I think he said, any debt incurred by Congress should not last over 17 years. And he did that by looking at what the average generation was, so that you didn't saddle a future generation with debt. But we're saddling the next two generations, perhaps three generations, and that's today. But the way the debt's going, hey, we're in trouble. We got a shattered economy, and the government's spending more money than they ever had before. And that is falling on our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, perhaps our great-great-grandchildren at this very moment. So a lot of the elements, the geographic one is the least responsible. That was something thrown in for rhetoric. The fact is, what is the relationship of the government to the people, whether they're across the ocean and it takes 4 to 6 weeks for information to go back and forth between the two, or when they're close and information doesn't go back between the two, it just goes one way from that swamp in Maryland down here to us on the high ground. It's a one way now. Back then, the House of Commons and the House of Lords seemed to be on the side of the people in many instances, not the colonists, but the people themselves. Back again to that English history, that the House of Commons in particular was always the defender of the people. But in this country, there are no defenders of the people anymore. There are defenders that get elected, and they're defending their best interests. They're defending the corporations that will feed their coffers so they can have the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars they need to get reelected. They're not looking out for the people. This is a government of the corporation, by the corporation, and for the corporation and the politicians. So that representation ceases to exist. That what the congressman tells you that he's going to do, he's telling you not what he's going to do, but what you think he's going to do so that you will vote for him. And if you can't realize that, next time somebody's running for office and you're going to support him, write down what his promises are and keep that list. Hang it on your refrigerator. Every time he violates the promise, put a big red line through it, that one unkept. And I think you will find very few politicians, and this was true of over 60% of the last election's Tea Party candidates, that by extending the Patriot Act and increasing the debt ceiling, they didn't represent the people that they promised that they would not do these things to. They were endeared to by the congressmen. They were taken to dinners and patted on the back, and they succumbed to the tactics of Washington, D.C., and voted against the very people that sent them there to do contrary to what they voted. So it's the representation that we need to look at, not the proximity, not the geography. Is numerous aspects of representation. One, like I say, they are taxing my great-grandchildren right now. So to heck with the island.
Well, yeah, and it's funny you should mention about taxing the unborn. The government's been doing that for quite some time now, and that should be one of the more severe grievances on the overall list. The cumulative list of like everybody's grievances is that, because they're literally taxing people that technically don't exist yet. But I really don't see people getting really that upset about it. I mean, they'll get upset about other things like this messianic figure or that messianic figure, and to a certain degree, I guess that's valid. But again, it comes down to an issue of priorities. You know, are you getting upset about the piece of gum stuck under your shoe? Or are you more concerned about the fact that you're slowly getting swallowed by quicksand? And I would argue that the quicksand that's swallowing the body politic is a lot more important than, you know, some gum that's stuck on the bottom of your shoe. So, again, going back to the carnival of distractions, I think one of the things we've seen in that is whoever shouts the loudest with the newest sensationalism will get you to focus on that piece of gum under your shoe instead of the quicksand that's basically killing everybody.
Well, there's another aspect, too, of comparing then and now, and I think that's what we should really be doing on this day, Patriots Day. Back then, nobody was looking for a leader. In fact, there were no leaders. There were a bunch of people who went to Philadelphia representing different colonies. Most of them had never met before. There was no leader there. In 1775, the Continental Congress, after Lexington Concord, designated a delegate from Virginia to be the commander of the Continental Army, the newly created Continental Army. It was non-existent when he got the job. There were no soldiers in the Continental Army, but they gave it to Washington. Now, Washington was then a leader of the Continental Army, but it was nothing. And it wasn't until after Valley Forge and von Steuben came in and taught close order drill and obedience to orders and military regime to the soldiers, so 1777, before Washington really had an army to lead. But he wasn't leading the country. He was only leading the army. He didn't lead the country. I guess you could say he started to in 1787 when he went to Philadelphia, but 1790 when he became the first president of the United States. So there were no leaders back then, and everybody says we got to find a leader and follow the leader. That's bullshit. The leader will show by his actions, not by his proclamations, his apparent bravado or anything else. If you're looking for a leader now, you'll never find him. If we look to begin doing what we have to, and within your community, find who your leaders are, the people that you know, and you see how they work, and then they go up to the county level, and then they go up to the state level. Then you have people developing as leaders and proving their worth by demonstrating their ability, not just somebody waving a flag saying, follow me, but people through hard work and effort have brought together pieces that have otherwise would have fallen apart. Those are candidates for leaders. But until you get to the level that warrants leadership, you got no reason to have a leader. If there was somebody right now, the image that I get of some people asking, we need a leader to follow, the image they're asking is for somebody to stand up and say, I'm the leader of the Patriot community. Well, if he was a good leader, he'd be dead. the next day. But chances are somebody that did that would be not shot because he would probably have other than the Patriot community as his best interest. Back then, Philadelphia was a long way from British soldiers. Where today is a long way from British soldiers until the white dots start appearing on the map and growing. And only within those white spots are they away from the British soldiers. But even then, it's not that far away because of the technology. So to think that a leader could come forward and not be executed would be to think that the government gave up because this guy proclaimed himself a leader, or that the government put that guy in place. So look to your town, look to your county. No further at this point. And until you secure your county and you see who helped you secure your county, do you have any idea what sort of leadership you want? Leadership isn't yelling and screaming and shouting. Leadership is thinking things out, picking the right course, and getting the job done. That's what leadership is. What job has been done? None. So how can you possibly pick a leader? If you establish a committee of safety, you will begin seeing the leadership characteristics in some people. Those become are now putting in the effort to earn the title of leadership, at least at the town level, and then maybe next at the county level, and maybe next at the state level. But don't look for some miracle to occur, and all of a sudden all CNN is going to tell you who the leader of the Patriot community is. We had one back in the 90s. Her name was Linda Thompson, self-proclaimed adjutant general of the United States Militia, I think is what she called herself. Nobody knows where Linda Thompson is now. She wasn't very good leading. She didn't get anything done.
Right, and I think that's very wise about what you said concerning leadership. You know, something I've noticed on my end is, you know, a lot of folks seem to respond at least in a visceral way to what I like to call the sexy stuff. And in this instance, whomever is the so-called leader that is the sexiest or does the most sexy thing, the most bravado, the loudest volume, the most grandiose displays of vanity, I guess, or some such thing. I don't know what else to say other than, you know, it's all theater. Again, carnal of distractions. It's just theater. That's really where it comes from. And here's the other thing too. If you guys want to have a messianic figure and you're really, or one out of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 that are running around now, you know, actually, here's the funny thing I've noticed. People who really want a messianic figure should be monarchists. And I just think that's something to take in consideration is maybe, you know, you shouldn't be a constitutionalist. Maybe you should be a monarchist if you really want a messianic figure. Just saying, it would fit that political orientation a little bit more concisely. Just saying. So, Fox, man, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, coming up on 11 o'clock here, I think what I'm going to do is put in Johnny Tremaine and spend the last hour trying to remember what happened today and not really focus on anything else because this day is especially important to me.
Yes, as it should be to all of us. And so, Gary, can you tell us just a little bit more about the Coalition of American Patriots before we close out for tonight?
Well, like I said, it was a phoenix that came out of the ashes and came out better and stronger because we saw some of the problems that are inherent when people aren't willing to let the whole group make the final decision, which is what was intended the first time. But like I said, it went into everybody, 26, 27 members, and a lot of them would rather make a pissing contest out of it and win by yelling louder than win by reason or rationale. So we got rid of those people. So that was one good. Those people we don't have to deal with now. They're gone. If they want to come back, hopefully they'll abide by the rules and understand that the rules were there. The other is that we have looked at that and made it better still. And what we, if we can get Kate, Coalition of American Patriots to bring on hundreds of organizations, we're going to have a common element there. They'll be working in diverse means. You don't have to agree with them. What was that one of the, how was that written in the guidelines, Sleepy? You have them in front of you. You don't have to agree with them, but you can't criticize what they're doing. That's all. You don't have to go along with them.
Right. It's actually guideline, I believe it's guideline 3. Members agree to disagree. It is acceptable to speak well of another member. It is not, however, acceptable to speak ill or in a disparaging manner of another member. Doing so will be cause for mediation.
So the idea is to avoid the infighting. It's not to force anybody to support somebody else. You just keep your mouth shut. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. I've heard that since I was a little kid, and I think it was my grandmother that first said it. And that's never left me. Why speak bad of people? It doesn't make sense. If you have something bad to say, just don't say it. Keep it to yourself. It doesn't have to come out. And then you have unity. Disagreement, but unity. But once those words come out, once the barking dogs begin, reason goes to the wayside. Reason ceases to exist. It's no longer part of the equation. And without reason, there is no way in the hell we're ever going to get our Constitution back.
Yes, amen. And I think we should start to wrap up this very special broadcast on this April 19th, 2012, in honor of Patriots Day. So thank you, Fox. Thank you, Gary, for coming on. Definitely do appreciate it.
Thank you, Randy, for when he listens to this and finds out we said thank you, Randy.
Thank you, Randy, too. All right, everybody, that pretty much wraps it up for tonight. And obviously, if you want to support this broadcast, go check us out on uftredemy.com. And please consider buying Colonel Joseph P. Martino's book, Resistance to Tyranny. That will help us out very much so we continue to run our operations, keep ourselves looking professional so we can attract other people who will help us to, well, what else, resist tyranny as much as possible. In any case, everybody, be safe, be free. Good night.
Hey, the British are coming! The British are coming!
Now the ride of Paul Revere set the nation on its ear, and the shot at Lexington heard round the world. When the British fired in the early dawn, the War of Independence had begun. The die was cast, the rebel flag unfurled. And on to Concord marched the foe, seized the arsenal,
so
there you know, waking
right.
Folks and searching all Fox. Around.
And
our militias stopped them in their tracks. At the old North Bridge, we turned them back. Chased those redcoats back to Boston town.
Baby,
hot shot heard around the world. Was the start of the revolution. The Minutemen were ready on the move. Take your powder, take your guns, report to General Washington. Hurry, men, there's not an hour to lose.
Now famous Bunker Hill. Though we had lost, it was quite a thrill. The rebel colonel, Prescott Poosie, was wise. Outnumbered and low on ammunition, the British stormed his position. He said, hold your fire till you see the white of their eyes.
The
next years were rough. General Washington's men, since they were tough. Those hungry, ragged boys would not be peeved. One night they crossed the Delaware, surprised the Hessians in their lair. And Valley Forge just bundled up their feet.
Now the shot heard round the world. Was the start of the revolution. The Minutemen were ready on the move. Take your
your blankets, take your sons, report to General Washington. We've got our rights and now it's time to prove.
Well, they showed such determination that they won the admiration of countries across the sea like France and Spain, who loaned the colony ships and guns and put the British on the run and the Continental Army on its feet again. Though we lost some battles too, the Americans swore they'd see it through. They kept up raiding parties, hit and run. At Yorktown, the British could not retreat. Bottled up by Washington and the French, with Cornwallis surrendered, and finally we had won.
Hooray! And the shot heard around the world. It was the end of the revolution. The Continental Rebel took the day. And the father of our country beat the British there at Yorktown. Brought freedom to you and me in the USA.